This is the Wheeler Center podcast.
My name is Pamela Paul. I'm the editor of the New York Times Book Review, and I am so pleased to introduce Anne Enright. She is the author of 5 novels, including the Booker-winning The Gathering, and most recently, The Green Road, which is the winner of the Irish Novel of the Year. Also the author of 2 story collections and a work of nonfiction, Making Babies. And she was the inaugural laureate for Irish fiction. Anne, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Pamela. Thank you.
So the topic we're going to talk about tonight is family and fiction. But before we go into that, I thought Anne might read a passage from The Green Road.
Okie doke, yeah. Yes, I will. Just to, this piece is about 6 minutes long. And it's from the beginning of the book. It is from Hannah, the youngest. She's 12, and it's from her point of view, and it's just a family dinner. And Dan, it's 1980. Dan, her eldest brother, has announced plans to become a priest, which has caused their mother much grief, or some grief. Anyway, oh, I've got the wrong page. Sorry about that. And... yeah, he made the big announcement at Sunday dinner, which the Madigans always did with a tablecloth and proper napkins, no matter what. On that Sunday, which was Palm Sunday, they had bacon and cabbage with white sauce and carrots, green, white and orange like the Irish flag. There was a little glass of parsley sitting on the tablecloth, and the shadow of the water trembled in the sunshine. Their father folded his large hands and said grace, after which there was silence, apart from the general sound of chewing, that is, and their father clearing his throat, as he tended to do every minute or so. The parents sat at either end of the table, the children along the sides, girls facing the window, boys facing the room, Constance and Hannah, Emmett and Dan. There was a fire in the grate, and the sun also shone now and then, so they were as warm as winter and warm as summer for 5 minutes at a time. They were twice as warm. Dan said, I have been speaking again with Father Fall. It was April, a dappled kind of day. The clean light caught the drops on the windowpane and all their multiplicity, while outside 1,000 baby leaves unfurled against branches black with rain. Inside, their mother had a tissue trapped in the palm of her hand. She lifted it against her forehead. Oh no, she said, turning away. And her mouth sagged open so you could see the carrots. He says, I must ask you to think again, that it's hard for a man who doesn't have his family behind him. It's a big decision I'm making, and he says, I must ask you, I must plead with you not to spoil it with your own feelings and concerns. Dan spoke as though they were in private, or he spoke as though they were in a great hall, but it was a family meal, which was not the same as either of these things. You could see their mother had an impulse to rise from the table, but could not allow herself to flee. He says, I'm to ask your forgiveness for the life you'd hoped for me and the grandchildren you will not have. Emmett snorted into his dinner. Dan pressed his hands down on the tabletop before swiping at his little brother fast and hard. Their mother blanked for the blow like a horse jumping a ditch. But Emmett ducked, and after a long second, she landed on the other side. She put her head down as though to gather speed. A moan came out of her, small and unformed. The sound of it seemed to please as well as surprise her. So she tried again. This next moan started soft and went long, and there was a kind of speaking to its last rise and fall. Oh, God, she said. She threw her head back and blinked at the ceiling once, twice. Oh, dear God. The tears started to run, one on top of the last, down to her hairline. 1, 2, 3, 4. She stayed like that for a moment while the children watched and pretended not to be watching, and her husband cleared his throat into the silence. Their mother lifted her hands and shook them free of her sleeves. She wiped her wet temples with the heels of her hands and used her delicate, crooked fingers to fix the back of her hair, which she always wore in a chignon. Then she sat up again and looked very carefully at nothing. She picked up a fork and stuck it into a piece of bacon, and she brought it to her mouth, but the touch of meat to her tongue undid her. The fork swung back down towards her plate, and the bacon fell. Her lips made that wailing shape, touching in the middle and open at the sides, what Dan liked to call her wide mouth frog look. Then she took a sharp inhale and went, It seemed to Hannah her mother might stop eating. Or if she was that hungry, she might take her plate and go into another room in order to cry. But this did not occur to her mother clearly, and she sat there eating and crying at the same time. Much crying, little eating. There was more work with the tissue, which was now in shreds. It was awful. The pain was awful. Her mother juddering and sputtering with the carrots falling from her mouth in little lumps and piles. Constance, who was the eldest, bossed them all quietly about, and they carried their plates and cups past their mother as she dripped one way or another into her own food. "Oh, Mammy," said Constance, leaning in with her arm about her to slip the plate neatly away. Dan was the eldest boy, so it was his job to cut the apple tart, which he stood to do, dark against the window light with the silver triangle of the cake slice in his hand. "You can count me out," said their father, who'd been playing in a tiny way with the handle of his teacup. He got up and left the room, and Dan said, "Five, so. How am I going to do five? There were six Madigans." Five was a whole new angle as he moved the cake slice through the ghost of a cross and then swung it 18 degrees to the side. It was a prizing open of the relations between them. It was a different story altogether, as though there might be any number of Madigans and out in the wide world, any number of apple tarts. Their mother's crying turned to funny, staggered inhalations. She dug into her dessert with a small spoon, and the children too were comforted by the pastry and by the woody sweetness of the old apples. Still, there was no ice cream on offer that Sunday, and none of them asked for it, although they all knew there was some. It was jammed into the ice box at the top right-hand corner of the fridge. That's the name.
You know, we Americans always find it really depressing and dreadful to be on stage with someone who's Irish, because we don't have that lovely lilt, and I have a flat New York accent, but I'll continue. Our subject is family and fiction, and it's hard to think of a writer who has mined this area with more penetrating psychological insight and at the same time a gritty, visceral detail than Anne. And in the process, I think you've also challenged the ideas, the way in which family is treated in fiction, and the assumptions about the way in which women in particular write about family in fiction. And I'm curious, do you think of family as your subject or as one of your subjects?
Well, I hadn't thought of family as my subject. I wrote The Gathering and I thought I was writing about memory and imagination and how things become true, how the past becomes true somehow, or what we know or don't know about the past. Anyway, I thought this is a very grand metaphysical subject, and I was just writing the Hegartys, there were 12 of them, and it was a huge technical challenge, but to me that was an existential problem, that Veronica in The Gathering is born so arbitrarily. She doesn't know why the hell Liam, her brother in particular, who's just died, she doesn't know why he was there in the first place. It just seemed that they were producing children because they had nothing better to do, or helplessly somehow. So I was writing the Hegartys, and they were all labelled Mossy was a psychotic, and it was the way that families talk about each other, one way or the other. To me, they were just content. They weren't really what the book was about. They were just somehow not colour quite, but just content. And I got quite a strong response from readers. There were two kinds of readers at the gathering. One of them said, well, one woman said, all my family's in that book and there's only four of us. I thought it was brilliant. And another one said, well, it's not like our family, of course. So there were two responses. It's like, so unlike the home life of our own dear queen. And I realised that I had got something, not about family so much. There is a really strong undersurge of incest in the gathering. I mean, that is part of the engine of the book, you know, the avoidance or the aversion or the style of love that a brother and a sister might have, you know. So I knew that I was playing that line because that's what, you know, the Greeks did. It's a very respectable line to play in fiction. So when I came to the Green Road, sorry, it's a long answer, I decided that I would look at what people recognised in the family thing. And I did look at structures and models for particular styles of families, I suppose, psychologically or whatever, and the labelling and how people get put in boxes. A lot of my fiction is about people getting out of boxes. So the roles that the kids are put in, partly by the mother, partly by each other, they're all playing in Rosaline's inner drama anyway. So they're trying to get out of whatever description Rosaline has made of them, which is always vaguely disappointed description.
But it's interesting because in your novels you get the sense that you're never really free from your family, that, you know, even Dan in The Green Road, who goes off to New York and then Toronto, and Ernest in The Gathering, that they never are entirely free of those expectations on them, both maternal and among their siblings.
Yeah, Dan is in New York and he comes back to a new relationship in New York, a guy called Billy, and he says, God, when are you done with all of that? His pregnant sister is a martyr there. Anyway, he's very far away as far as he's concerned, and he's gone. And neither of the boys in the book, the book is very much about leaving and coming home, and neither of them spend a lot of time worrying about, thinking about, contacting or connecting with their family or particularly their mother. It's just not their personal style or their social style. Constance stays at home and Hannah has just difficulties about it all. But Dan is averse to coming home because he feels he won't be understood, which is pretty much all of us, isn't it?
Pretty much true.
I mean, the thing is, though, you walk back in to your family, maybe or maybe not. I think all families... Are all families different? I think, when I think of my own family, and people say constantly, what do they think, and are they worried, and all the rest of it, it's taken me a long while to realise that I write a kind of mythopoetic family. It's not actually the people I see on Christmas Day, or it's not really the same.
Your fiction also seems to be about how much or how little we can know about each other, even among family members, that there's that idea that there's the concept we have of one another and then the reality and the conflicts between those.
Yeah. I mean, well, very deliberately in this book, we know an awful lot about each of the siblings before they meet up. So the dialogue should have all of this knowledge. You know, when they start talking to each other, we know what the subtext is somehow. And we also know more about them than they know about each other. And it is slightly to do with the incest taboo again, because when we go out into the world, one of the things we do is we make our own families. And there's pretty much only one way to do that, you know. I mean, sex is the way the families are made. And,
just to clarify.
And that's not something that any family member wants to know anything about, thank you very much. But also, under that kind of that term, includes all kinds of senses of adventure and connection and not family that we're doing elsewhere. And we can't... You know, you go back and say, oh, this, that, and the other, and wow, and oh dear, and they say, have you turned out the bathroom light? Or you're always like that, or
And yet in the gathering, a lot of what the framework is around about Veronica kind of trying to fill in the gaps about her grandparents to understand what it is that she doesn't know about Ada and about Charlie and Lam Nugent and sort of her trying to imagine and then not knowing what the difference between what she's trying to conjure and what the reality is.
Yeah, I think... in Veronica's case, it's more of that idea of what is the secret? What is the secret? Is it a dark secret? It is a dark secret in the book as it translates through the generations. And something about the grandparents' generation makes that available to her, that she can storify it. I mean, she can make it into a story, she can make it into history, she can put it into costume, she can look at the old photographs somehow and make them move around and understand their story and describe it in a way that she wouldn't be able to do for her parents' generation, because her parents are just a kind of a question mark for her, kind of a blur. It's like, in both of these books, you're astonishingly familiar with your family. You know the grain of their voice, the sound of their footsteps. You're very physically aware of your families. It's always a shock to see how old they've got. but how you don't know them in their outside selves, you know.
Right, it's almost like you're totally familiar with who they were as children when you're growing up, so that you're not ever able to fully see them as adults.
Yeah, or that familiarity is a kind of comfort and a drag at the same time. That's where you live when you're together. You're back in that zone.
To what extent do you think, as you're writing about family, specifically about the Irish family, as opposed to about families in general?
I really don't know. I mean, it depends on the response. I don't know, does it depend on the town or the culture? But there are some countries where you go and people recognise it very strongly, and you realise the world is constituted of families. I mean, maybe in Manhattan and London, people don't have families. I remember a guy in London said, or maybe they do, and
we've just left them.
You just left them, But this guy in London, he said, I'm not going home for Christmas, I hate my family. And I go, oh, there's posh. I mean, what has hating them got to do with it? Of course. I mean, like, wow. You know, whereas in Ireland, there's absolutely no, you know, it doesn't matter what you think. You're home one way or the other. It's partly because the island is so small. But also, I think it's very strongly part of the migrant and emigrant story. So that people not being able to come back for Christmas, or not being able to come back at key moments, or being able to come back. So that the family in the Irish context is the thing that is left as a sorrowful connection or a sorrowful thing. And so that somehow makes the family even more iconic than the Catholic Church already does, you know. So it is the iconic unit, and it is, I think, the strongly functioning social unit in Ireland. I mean, families are very tight in Ireland. You really do stick by your family one way or the other, I think.
I wonder, is your Irish readership in a way more exacting in terms of their expectations of your depiction of the Irish family, as opposed to, you know, people from New York or Australia who might just think, well, that's how they are in Ireland?
Well, I don't know. I think readers tend to psychologize hugely, and they're always drawing connections between your characters, whether you've done it or looking for reasons or complaining about what they do or they don't do. The writer is more interested in structures and shapes and other kind of dynamics. You know, you're interested in what kind of pot you can put it in, you know. So I don't get huge amounts of... the other thing, the Irish readership is very silent. I remember after the gathering was finished, I went down to the school, and this woman looked at me in the lina, as we call it, the line going into bring the small kids into the classroom, and she just looked at me, and I said, what did I do to her? Then I realised, oh, she's read the book, right?
Right.
But this particular... nobody would ever say, Jesus, page 63. I mean, there might be a little bit of like, oh well, now, but it's almost a sanctioned space. The book always has been this in Ireland. It is a place where anything can be said, you know, going back to Ulysses and all the rest of it. But poor Jimmy, poor Joyce, poor Joyce's family. I mean, I was reared hearing that. Poor James Joyce's sister, who worked with my granny. Poor woman.
A lot of your writing about family, a lot of writing about family in general, not yours, seems strangely divorced from its starting point, which is to say sex. And you seem in your writing to thwart that deliberately. Is that a conscious thing?
That just
to I mean, your books are about family, but they're also about sex. And you write a lot about sort of the tensions and the overlap between familial love and sexual love and romantic love.
I mean, I think what I said earlier, that families are made by sex, this is one of the great forgotten mysteries. I mean, it's the kind of... and also, really weirdly, I mean, that we kind of chase away from reproduction. And when you think about sex, you might think about, in this kind of age of pornographic anxiety, we think that sex is something about bikinis or something. But it's not. It's actually about producing children. That is actually what it's about. We spend an immense amount of time not saying that, avoiding that. So certainly in media terms, and you'd be hard put to put the whole picture together. It's like it's like we're all somehow children. That sex is this. Well, actually, it's how you got onto the planet. So I am interested in I'm slightly burdened by my characters are burdened by loving people. That's it. Loving. You don't choose your family, you love your family. I mean, what's that about? I mean, why do you not have a choice? And how do you manage that love? And also, you love your children and they love you, and that seems to me both glorious and doomy. It's like, they really don't have a choice. And you really don't have a choice. And you have a choice. The only one you have a choice about is your romantic partner. That's the only love that you choose or don't choose. It just seems maybe there's a lot more of the biological love in the world than there is romantic love. If you know, I mean, genetic love than there is sexual love. And you wouldn't know that looking at the newspapers either.
What's the most challenging thing about capturing family, the way families really operate in a novel?
I don't really bother about it, really. I mean, because in The Gathering, it was completely unintended. I didn't set out to do anything. I think mostly I'm setting out to do something else, and I use the characters along the way.
Do you have a challenge for yourself? Do you set yourself some kind of challenge with each novel?
Yeah, sort of. I think when you're sitting down, you're always 3 or 4 years older than the last time you started a book.
Right.
So the challenge is to partly know where you're at, a little bit. I think you do have to own the change of whatever, you know, experience, your own changing self, or your own mutability somehow. And then you've got a new set of problems in your head, and you're asking new questions of life, and you only know what the question is when you finish the book. But when I'd finished this book, The Green Road, I recognised that the question was somehow about compassion. And I'd been thinking about people, you're thinking about people. So there's a kind of gossipy level of challenge. And when you said, well, why is it that people who are unhappy, people who are happy are people who are looking after other people? And if you're unhappy, it makes you quite selfish, and being selfish makes you unhappy. So it's a kind of a self-enclosed kind of thing. And so that was one of the questions I had been asking. But more urgently or more creatively, I had in the book a sense of space. I had a sense of geography. So that was the challenge I set myself, was about places.
Did you actually go to Mali, for example? Was it Mali?
I think it was Mali.
And, I mean, you captured these eras. For those who haven't read the novel, there's a big section in New York in the early 90s that was very specific to that time and place, and the gay community during the AIDS crisis at that time, and then the period in Mali. Did you do a lot of research?
I did a huge amount of research about Emmett, because I thought I was going to write about a human. I don't know what I thought I was doing. There's always about three books that fall away, you know. So I thought I was going to write this. I was really interested in the aid and humanitarian community, partly because it's a missionary tradition in Ireland, and I know people who had joined the missions as priests and nuns had gone away. And I also know people, still to this day, there's always, if there's a famine, there's an Irish person there handing out the high protein bars and whatever else that it is an Irish tradition. And I was looking, interested in the paths that people took that were not the classically done New York, Boston, London, Australia, maybe even Australia. So I was looking at other trails that Irish people make through the world. And I can't remember the question. But there's a little bit of jet lag there. So
it's jet lag versus jet lag here.
It's a lag off. lagging off now.
All right, I'll give
no,
you...
No, it was... Yes?
No, keep going.
So, yes, I had
gone. It was about
gone.
Research.
It was research, yeah. Research, yes.
We remembered the question.
After I'd lurched and stumbled through various towns, including Melbourne in 2008, at the end of the year, I went to Uganda to do a piece for The Guardian about, they'd done a year-long observation of a community in northern Uganda called Katine. And although I'm hugely interested in this subject, I found I couldn't read any of the articles. And I thought, how do you make people interested in this? That was one challenge. Also, the aid community isn't very open. Doesn't talk about what's going on. It doesn't talk about whether the money goes to arms or wherever, because they want the money to keep coming in. So there's a kind of piety to the discourse. They're all in very short-term contracts. All of that was huge. I thought, anyway, I went to Uganda, and instead of talking about myself, I was looking around, and I was incredibly nourished by it. It was just terrific not to be in a hotel somewhere and not talking about myself at night. It was just great, and I thought, well, that's interesting. So I did, I went to Honduras for another article about land tenure there. It's a very tough part of the world. And so I met hugely interesting people, and I wanted to... I mean, Emmett doesn't honour them. He's a chilly bastard, really, Emmett, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's sort of the least empathetic character, ironically, yeah, of all of them.
He's the most morally good, I mean, but he's the... Yeah.
When we talk about challenges in the novel, I thought you were going to bring up structure. You alluded to it a little bit earlier, but the structure of the novel is really interesting in that you begin with the family together, and then you do a sort of leap forward in time and place, where you have a chapter devoted to each of the characters, and then I'm not going to give away the ending, don't worry, but then they reunite
and they do
for
come
Christmas,
home. Yeah.
But then you don't do the obvious thing and end there, and then it continues... in the same time and in the same place after that sort of momentous gathering.
I mean, the structure is imperfect in the book. And sometimes a writer will realise with great relief that they can just write a book that takes place in 24 hours, or wouldn't that be wonderful? And they have a structure, and then they... But this structure was slightly grown in the dark, as I grow my books like mushrooms in the dark. And so the structure made itself apparent. I had been thinking, as I said, geographically, and I also had to have another access over time. So each of these sections takes place essentially in a different place. So, as I say, I don't it's a bit flawed. I quite like that it's a bit flawed because it's wrong for a reason. It made its own demands. Dan leaves not just that dinner table, not just Ireland, and not just his mother, but he leaves the book for 60 pages, you know, or 50 pages. And that seemed to be necessary and right to me. But also each of those sections, people say, are they like short stories? But in fact, they're like different languages to me a little bit. But I don't know I didn't make that foreground that.
It's interesting that you say that it's flawed, because to me the structure felt like a metaphor for the way in which families operate, because you have everyone go off and then you have them come back together, and in the old-fashioned novel it would have sort of all been tied together neatly with a bow at that point where everything is kind of resolved, and you have this sort of, this again I'm not going to reveal the ending, but a semi-resolution there, and then it goes on in the way that families continue on even after you have a major event.
Yes, it's a bit like life. Yeah, so you want the book to be a bit, you know, I mean, you could say postmodern by saying these sections come out of essentially different novels, and each character has their own novel. But you could also say it's more like life than like a book at the end.
I want to go back to the idea about compassion and empathy. In what ways is the book really about compassion?
Well, When I finished the book, my editor said that each of the characters faces mortality, but I had thought that each of them faces a challenge to their compassion. And then I thought, well, maybe that's the same thing in some way. That Dan, in New York, he's surrounded by amazing, far too interesting times he's living through in New York. And there's an invitation there to him to step up. And he doesn't really take it. And you don't really blame him either. At the end of the chapter, the narrator, the choral narrator says, you know, these things are hard. These things are hard. So you don't really judge him. He just wasn't in a place where he could look after other people. Then Constance does nothing but look after other people. She stays at home and looks after other people. And then at the end of her section, there's a kind of thing where she just feels terrible about this poor woman that she wasn't brilliant to in the queue in a hospital, and she not being good releases a kind of a sense of abandonment. I think it's the only place the word abandonment is used in the novel. And you say, well, why are you so good, Constance? it doesn't come from an easy place for her. It comes from a place of self-denial and difficulty. It comes from, and that's how she fixes her life. But hey, not a bad solution. And then Emmett is good. He's good. But he doesn't love anyone.
It's an interesting... The other thing that
Hannah's a mess. Yeah.
That you play with is you constantly upend expectations in this novel. So it's a situation where you think something's going to happen and then something else happens. And with Dan, you think Dan's going to get AIDS. And then you think, with Constance, she's going to get cancer. There's an early scene, I think one of the best scenes, in the waiting room of a breast cancer clinic. And you think, okay, I know what's going to happen. And then it doesn't happen. And then later on, there's a scene with the mother where you think, okay, I know something terrible is going to happen. It doesn't happen.
Yeah, that's a bit like
Hannah,
life as well.
Actually, Hannah, in the first sort of adult scene.
You think she's going to, she's dying on the floor.
She's dying on the floor. You have a couple of scenes where you think someone's on the brink, and then they're not.
That's very well observed. Yes, I mean, if you look at the stories of Alice Munro, they have that gothic element. And the wonderful thing at the end of the stories is that things happen to be all, it's okay. So these fears and dreads and events and near misses or nearly, I mean, occasionally in Alice Munro, like, terrible things do happen. But mostly people come through. And so I am interested in those fantasies of near, you know, that we live every you know, every so often, or maybe even daily, we think of some disaster.
The worst case scenario, the sort of catastrophic thinking.
Yeah, You're talking about, well, I mean, you travel and you think your children are going to die. But, you know, but here we all are. Everything's fine.
I'm going to go back to 2004. The subject here is fiction and family, but I want to turn to nonfiction and to a book you wrote back then called Making Babies. You'd written a couple of novels and short story collections before writing that book. Why did you turn to memoir to write about motherhood?
This is a book I wrote when I thought I had no readers at all. And if I thought I was going to get some readers, I wouldn't have told them all of that stuff. it should be called Too Much Information. Making Babies, : Too Much Information. I wrote it, I was sparked into writing it by an editor in Dublin of the Dublin Review called Brendan Barrington. He said, will you write the story of Rachel, my daughter's birth? And I said, oh, okay. And I had been online when I was waiting for labour and all of that kind of thing, those long nights doing jigsaws and going online and reading people's accounts of their labour. And it was quite interesting as a kind of a way that women were talking, and they were talking online and they were writing accounts, and clearly it was really important. These are really important. It's a birth is, of course, as important as writing about a death, you know. It's like big stuff, and it's not, you know, and it's not something that you talk about at the bus stop, although some people do.
Increasingly.
Back. Yeah. But online, and I was wondering how bad it was going to be, how good it... Anyway, so I was interested in this form, which was a popular form. And then this editor is an American and has a very particular idea of what nonfiction is, I think. Like quite a New York idea of what nonfiction is. And so I could see the piece that I would write for the Dublin Review, and it was the first piece in that periodical. And a woman came up to me afterward, much later, and she was crying, and she said, I read that piece, and I thought, I've never made anyone cry. Not that I know of. And so that's very interesting. So I thought... And then, so the book grew from there. And
let's make more people cry.
Let's make more people cry. in a good way, I think, you know. There was a very irate letter to The Guardian that was complaining that I hadn't had a miscarriage and was writing about birth, because they thought that thing, something dreadful is going to happen in this narrative.
That's what they wanted.
Well, why else would you read it? Why else would anyone write about a pregnancy unless it was going to end terribly? Anyway, there was a baby. She's lovely.
Did you find there were things that you could ways that you could write about motherhood, things you could say in nonfiction that were not as accessible in fiction?
No, or? I think in fiction is where you could really go to the dark side. You know, that is... and certainly with Hannah, I did quite a lot of that. And in fact, nonfiction writing about these human beings, there was a kind of poet's impulse that if you're going to write about people, you're going to enhance them in some way. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're going to love them. I mean, the book is full of complaints and stupidities and all kinds of banging on. But there is, as I was typing, a sense that I was loving these people rather than... exposing them. That's what people feel when you write about them in print, you know.
I want to talk for a second about Hannah before going back to Making Babies. You just said that, you know, Hannah is... I mean, there's a kind of very brutal depiction of motherhood and of the contradictions between sort of maternal love and maternal resentment, and even perhaps darker than that.
Yeah, a bit darker, because Hannah isn't really getting the love thing, I don't think. She's not that aspect of it. And it's really interesting, because whenever I'm on in a public forum... People ask me about Constance, Emmett, and Dan, and they never ask about Hannah. You're like, I said to one person, what about Hannah? He said, we'll get to Hannah in a minute.
Hoping the time
would
run away.
Yeah. So this is a rare thing that I'm asked about Hannah, because I mean, all of Hannah's issues, all of Rosaline's, you know, Rosalie's endlessly disappointed in her children, and she's quite self-involved and not full of self-knowledge. But all of that, anyway, that all comes out in Hannah when she has a baby herself. So all her issues are writ large, or they become really, really impossible and big for her for that time. So, there are funny little things about Hannah that are usually said about men. She feels really, it's quite an extreme situation. I don't know.
A lot of ambivalence.
Yeah, no, the baby, not to give the plot away, but she's I do remember, actually, being very sick and lying on the sofa, and my eldest was completely happy, sitting there in her nappy and completely happy. And I thought, I could fucking die. But just because I'm here and I'm not moving, you're happy. If I got up and went out to make a cup of tea, you'd be like, where are you? Where are you? So that is much more extremely done with Hannah, because she's in extremis and the baby is just really pleased to see her. And so she doesn't say, what about me? But there are those feelings out there. I don't know if it's resentment of the baby that... It's more. I'll have to look at it again now, to be honest, because I rarely talk about it.
She says the things that mothers aren't supposed to say, you know, about their babies and their feelings towards them.
The baby is let off fairly lightly in this. She manages not to be not to focus on her negativity on the actual baby.
And it's interesting, though, because you must see Hannah as a central figure, because the novel starts off with her narrating it, and then she's the last one of the siblings that you come
to. And it was really sad. I mean, I really wanted the women in this book to have a better time. I really wanted that to happen. And it's based in 2005, and there are all kinds of things you think, well, social shifts or whatever possibilities. And I wanted them to have a better time. But just the fact of Rosaline and Dan Madigan, just the way it was, I couldn't spring them into a better life. They were one way or the other. The failures of Rosaline's mothering were writ large one way or the other. And I mean, Constance has a good enough time.
It sounds like the characters kind of get away from you in a way, that they're from your original intention.
Well, at that dinner table that I read, it's all pretty much there. Emmett's cynicism, Dan's fakery, Rosaline's self-dramatizing, Constance doing the dishes, which she does for the rest of her life. Never start. As I don't tell my children. Aunt Hannah, and that gaze that she has of the mother crying and the tears, that's quite a stunned gaze. And you think, well, that's quite a creative, artistic gaze. She's quite tranced by it all. So there's two ways it could go. I mean, she could end up using it and integrating it, and or it could just fall apart for her. And it does fall apart. Now, I don't think Hannah's I think in the long term she's going to be all right, put it that way.
Going back to making babies for a second, you said at the time in another interview that you sort of turned the problem in your life, the babies, you said the problem and the joy in your life, your real life, into a solution in your writing life.
Yeah.
I thought that was really interesting, and I'm wondering if with this novel, was there something that you were grappling with or thinking about that you sort of tried to... resolve or...
Yeah, I mean, I have a little rule that the problem is the solution. When I got pregnant, an older novelist, I've never said this before, said, oh, well, that'll soften your cough. As in, you'll never write another book. Ha, 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 ha. So now every time I finish a book, I have a memorial cough. and, you know, the feeling that... I wouldn't write again. So I realised that the only solution was to write about the babies. So, yeah. So that problem is... That problem of compassion was real to me when I started this book about how unhappiness. About unhappiness. That was the problem. The unhappiness that I saw in other people, my own unhappiness, how that's broken open, or how you get out of the circle of it. And I have in all my work, I think, been interested in the circumference of the self. People, you know, particularly from the first person point of view in The Forgotten Waltz and The Gathering, and the limits and of solipsism and what you can see and what you, yeah. So I needed and wanted to break out of a sense of self in the book, and that's one of the reasons that it's in four sections at the beginning.
I have about 15 other questions for you, but I'm going to restrain myself from selfishly taking up the rest of the time and turn it over to our audience. So if any of you have any questions, there are people coming around with microphones. Just indicate to them.
Hi. You said that Hannah will do well, which presumably means you really are involved in this family. Is there a risk of a sequel, or perish the thought of prequel?
Oh, a prequel. Actually, I know loads about Rosaline's parents and Pat Madigan's parents, who were on opposite sides in the Civil War. And Pat Madigan, one of his relatives, the story was that he was shot and the chemist wouldn't treat him, pulled down the blinds. So I could write that, but other people have written that book, haven't they? So there's a lot that I've taken out of the book, both pre and post. And this is what you're getting. Let that be enough.
Turning back to The Gathering, could you talk a little bit about the haunting in the book and the presence of the ghosts and the dead, and how that might parallel in your own life?
In my own life? It might parallel more properly in my own sentences. As in, some of the ghosts in The Gathering are just things in the way the sentence goes, you know? Do you know what I mean? It's just like a statement of something that is imagined, or like a poet might sometimes say, this is in the room, and you know it's not in the room. There's some of them are like that. They're just metaphorical. Some of the ghosts in The Gathering are about the thing that has never been said, and the ghost in the room is the elephant in the room. There are, and some of it is about things that won't die, because they aren't known or resolved. So there are a lot of different style of ghosts in The Gathering. My own life isn't so. I can't remember the word. What would you call it? Ethereally inclined.
Hi, I just like to ask you what you think it is about an Irish family that can tell its story to such a universal audience.
Well, part of me says, well, why do we have to, why are we the only ones who have mothers? Why do we have to have mothers for everyone? Because, of course, everyone comes from a family. That's one of the, or some style of a family. Or not, tragically, you know what I mean? Everyone has family in mind somehow. But I don't know why the Irish, maybe that, I don't know. I mean, I was talking to an audience in Dublin before I had finished, as I was writing the book, and I was avoiding like crazy the idea that it would all happen over Christmas dinner. I was really, as in, I can't do this now. I just can't. I mean, I had been avoiding bog and field for the first half of the book, and then I succumbed to bog and field, and I said, no, I'm not going so far as Christmas. And then I realised that everybody in the audience was going home in a month's time, exactly, it was in November, and they were all going back to their Christmas. And it's just true. It's just true of how we conduct ourselves somehow. I don't know the answer.
Back in the 80s, I read a book called Moral Monopoly by Tom somebody or other, I can't remember his surname. But in that book, there was a chapter on the Irish mother and the effect that the Catholic Church had on the Irish mother, the control the Catholic Church had over the Irish mother. I was wondering, in view of the debate that's going on at the moment about the maternity hospital in Dublin, whether or not the Catholic Church is in the last throes of controlling the Irish mother.
I was just remembering the other, just travelling here, people had been, somebody had asked me, I was in Auckland, and somebody was asking me about reproduction and over-reproduction, overproduction. And I remember women of my mother's generation saying of a small family up the road, he only gave her two. So it wasn't all imposed, put it that way, but there was, I remember other stories as well, as you may well imagine. And the maternity hospital story is a really astonishing thing that's happening in Dublin at the moment, where the Sisters of Charity are going to be given ownership of the new maternity hospital. Who these women are, I don't know. They just took a vow. I don't know if they're qualified or anything. Anyway, they've been running hospitals in Ireland since the year dot and saying things like, now you're paying for your minute's pleasure. That's one quote. Actually, they're not so active in Holles Street, but a friend of mine had a baby in Holles Street 5 years ago, the lovely Lawrence, and she asked a medical question in Holles Street and was told to put her trust in the Blessed Mother. The wrong person to say that to. So it just drags on in the most amazing way. In the most amazing way. And this is because of land ownership, contractual, legal, just in the most astonishingly tenacious way. And you realise the Catholic Church thinks in terms of 1,000 years. So how we all feel about them at the minute, not brilliantly, doesn't matter a damn. So they'll hang on to every single last brick. It's really interesting. How a society can change and not change at the same time is one of the things, and the layers of change and where things lodge, and things lodge in documents about land and all that kind of carry on.
Couldn't they just hand over the ownership of the St. Vincent's to the state?
That's a great idea. I must put it to Sister Agatha. You could Google Sister Agatha. She's one of the people who actually runs that hospital. You can see, you can Google all of them and you won't find a picture, but sure, they wouldn't want a photograph. No accountability, nothing. No transparency, no.
Hello, Anne.
Actually, I'm going to get my daughter to join the Sisters of Charity so that when they all die, she's going to own Ireland. Sorry.
I'm over here. I'm interested in your development as a writer. Could you take us through a potted history?
Or decline, perhaps. potted history. I always wrote, and I'm still doing it. And I wrote bad poetry at school, and then I wrote a fragment I was quite interested in at college, and then I tried to write a proper story, and I really failed at writing a proper story for a long time, and that was a third-person past tense narrative. And then I wrote some bits and bobs and went and did an MA in creative writing in the University of East Anglia, where I didn't write anything. And then came home and wrote 4 stories in a row, and they were published. Then I got a job on RTE by accident. I was 6 years in television production. And then I went full-time in 1993. And with great pain, anxiety, and difficulty, produced 2 novels. Then I had kids and I didn't care anymore and I just started typing.
Do you think there are any differences between Irish Catholic families and Protestant families?
Chutney, hot water bottles. Um, That's a terrible thing to say about Protestants. I take it all back. I know a Protestant family who were very wealthy and they had 11 children in the last generation because they were in love. And but anyway, there was a difference. On the road where I grew up, there were three Protestant families, about 42 Catholic families and one Jewish family. And the Protestant families limited the size of, limited the number of their children. In mysterious ways. And I mean, tribally speaking, there were the people did sense whether they existed or not differences. And I would be reluctant to overindulge that tribalism, if you know what I mean. Does that make sense? But the hot water bottles are fabulous. And the chutney nonpareil.
Hi. I don't mean to be rude by mentioning another writer, but I wonder whether you've read Jonathan Franzen or talked to him about mothers and families.
That's a really wildly interesting question because you're now going to get me to admit that I haven't read Jonathan Franzen. I sort of skimmed and I had a good smell at the book. And I checked a bit at the Christmas bit. Oh yeah, no, that's all right. Yeah.
Nobody tell Jonathan Franzen.
It's okay, I think he'll survive. I think he'll survive. Who do I read? Well, I always read Alice Munro. And at the moment I'm reading, or I have been reading, these young American chicks who write whatever they want.
Like which ones?
Well, Miranda July and Maggie Nelson and who else? Rachel Kushner. And I'm enjoying the whole go with them. I'm just the energy and the kind of intellectual risk and determination that's involved. I like all of that. I'm reading Tolstoy's Confessions, but that's only because I have to. And yeah, I don't talk about my real reading much because there's so much reading you do professionally. And I only realise why I'm really reluctant to do that now because this is only true. My mother taught me to read when I was three, and this was discovered on the road. Where I grew up, and there was performance reading was obliged of me. The neighbours were bringing out the books and saying, read that now. She's three. So when I'm asked about what I'm reading, it feels like performance reading, as opposed to that very kind of close, what must have been very lovely, real reading that I was doing with my mother. So I'm a bit weird and neurotic now, and it's taken me about 20 years to know that enough to say it. I used to just lie and say, yes, I'm going. Well, I do go back to Proust. I am going back to Proust, yes.
What Proust, the author who most influenced you growing up?
It's really hard to determine what influence is. I mean, some of the things that were available to me as a young person were just, you wouldn't claim them as influences. I mean, things like Yeats, you can say, I can't say Yeats is an influence. That, to me, that's a whole kind of game of claiming. That the boys do. And I don't do it much. You know, I was seriously influenced by Joyce, but I live in the shadow of Joyce and blah, 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 blah. I love Joyce. Love Joyce, but not Dubliners. I thought it was really boring. And now I think it's wonderful. So books change over the years. I liked Nabokov at one stage. My God.
We are completely out of time, alas. So a big hand to Anne Enright. Thank you
and
so
thank
much.
You. Thank you very much. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.